Hi, and welcome to Five Compelling Questions with Sean. This is the podcast where we talk to writers about writing, the creative process, how they got started, all those kinds of things through a series of five questions. But we always end up asking more than five questions. But anyway, it's a lot of fun. We've been getting to know a lot of interesting facts about writers, and it's been really great. So I'm excited to have my guest today, Paul Martin. Hey, Paul.
Hi there. How are you, Sean?
I'm good. Thanks for coming on the show. I'm going to do a brief introduction for you, for those that don't know who you are. Paul Martin is a former book and magazine editor with the National Geographic Society, which is way cool. His writing assignments have taken him around the world. He's the author of 11 books of fiction and nonfiction. He has also edited or contributed to a dozen other books on history, culture, and science. An amateur luthier and one-time vineyard owner and winemaker, Martin lives near Washington, D.C. So two things. I had to look up luthier real quick. I knew what that was. And I'm like, oh, that's a fancy word. So you'll have to tell us what that is. And then I also live near Washington, D.C. I think on the other side of D.C. though than you do. So tell us about luthier. What is a luthier?
Basically, an acoustic instrument builder. In my case, I started playing the guitar, and I was obsessed with high-end expensive guitars. I ended up owning 20 Martins and Taylors and Gibsons, and my wife was ready to throw me out of the house. So I ended up selling all of those, and I decided I would make my own guitars. That way, I would hang on to them. And it would take me enough time that I wouldn't end up with 20. I did end up with 10 instruments, but I'd given 6 of them away. So now I only have 4 of my own handmade guitars.
Wow, that's really impressive. That's really cool that you became so interested in it. You just decided I'm just gonna do this. That's pretty neat. So do you play guitar on a daily basis, or what are you still playing?
I do. I have them in our family room, and lots of times when I'm sitting there watching TV, I just turn the volume off and just play my guitar.
Wow, that's neat. So what kind of music do you play? Do you like rock and roll?
Mostly 60s and 70s rock, pop stuff, Beatles, mm-hmm. James Taylor, all the stuff that was popular when I was a young guy. And the one song I would really, I'm self-taught. I don't read music. I just play chords and arpeggios and finger picking and various things. And if I had the talent, the one song I would be content with being able to play is Classical Gas. If I could ever master that song, I would feel like I was a real guitarist.
So that's your crescendo. That's going to be the one.
That would be it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that kind of ties into your books, because you write it's the Music and Murder Mysteries, right? The Music and Murder series. Yeah. So tell us about what are the titles of the books, and why did you choose that? This is not an official question. I'm just curious. Tell us the titles of your books.
Well, my first book was called Killing Floor Blues, which is the title of a Skip James song from 1932. And it was written during the Depression. And it was basically about how tough times were, Killing Floor Blues. And the origination of the idea of writing mysteries that had some musical element, it was kind of weird. I was riding, doing my morning exercises, riding my stationary bike. And for some reason, a book called Someone is Killing the Great Chefs of Europe popped into my mind. And I suddenly was thinking, you could take that title and plug in any work group. Somebody is killing, the former president. Somebody is killing a great football star, whatever you want. And I thought blues musicians, since I'm a huge fan of the early blues musicians, Charlie Patton, Son House, all the early greats who are all acoustic, none of this plugged in high volume electric stuff. And I thought, oh, that's pretty cool. So the actual working title of my first mystery was Someone is Killing the Great Blues Musicians. I ended up changing it to Killing Floor Blues simply because I thought it was shorter and punchier. And I didn't want to steal somebody else's title. But that led me into an area that I've always been fascinated. Number one, music. Number two is history and biography. Those are all primary interests throughout my life. And so I was able to combine all of these interests and research the history of the blues throughout the Depression era and these various musicians, all of whom I happened to bump off in the course of my story. But that was how the idea evolved. And then after that, I had worked on a story off and on for years about Cuba. And originally, it really didn't have anything to do with music. And it wasn't a murder mystery. And the story sort of never went anywhere. And after I did Killing Floor Blues, I thought, you know, if I made that a murder mystery and added the music of Cuba, which is some of the most fascinating music ever, it's where the rumba originated, the mambo, the tango, the cha-cha, the salsa, all that originated in Cuba. And so that allowed me to develop a story around, the history of Cuba, which is what I was fixated on, and add a murder mystery and musical elements. So that's where those two are. And now I'm working on a third story, which is set in the late 1960s. And it's a departure because I actually lived through that era. And now you're talking about my generation, it's like all the music that when I was in high school and college, was familiar with. So I'm having a lot of fun with that.
That's cool. Good. Well, what's the title of the second book? That one just came out.
It's Summer of Love, which is set in San Francisco. And that's where the Summer of Love started, San Francisco in 1967, which was the year I graduated from college. So I was right there in the Summer of Love.
Very cool that you're the same age as my mom, I think. Yeah, because my mom, but I, as a Generation X person, I had my wall in my room was covered with Beatles stuff. And I listened to the Stones and the Beatles and Jimi Hendrix. Oh, yeah. I was fascinated with Woodstock, like growing up in the 80s. But I dropped my son off at middle school and all the kids are wearing Nirvana t-shirts now.
Right.
That's like the 20 years ago thing for them. So I think everyone's just like, yeah.
My story actually starts at the Monterey Pop Festival, which happened in May of 1967. That preceded Woodstock. And that really set the stage for outdoor rock concerts. There had been other outdoor concerts. There was a Monterey Jazz Festival. But this was the first big outdoor rock concert and sort of set the mold.
Yeah, that's the one Jimi Hendrix lit his guitar on fire.
That's right.
Remember that? Well, I don't remember it. I wasn't there, but I have seen video. Right.
Well, you can see it on video. Also, that was where Pete Townsend from The Who bashed his Fender guitar to pieces. And it was the first time that Janis Joplin had a really big audience. And she sang, I forgot what the song she was singing, but she was just, how she screams and goes on and on. And they kept panning across the audience and people had their mouths open. They were just staring at her with their mouths open, like, what is going on?
Yeah, it was a revolution for sure. And the culture, it was just, that's when it all sort of came together. I was watching an interview one long time ago with Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead. And he said, it was either Monterey or might've been Woodstock. I can't remember which one he was talking about, but he said it must've been Monterey. Cause he said they were on the bill in between Jimi Hendrix and The Who. And he said the most forgettable spot on the lineup because Jimi Hendrix comes out, lights everything on fire. Right. And then he said, we came out and played our little tunes, do-do-do. And then The Who, first time in America, destroy their whole set or whatever. And he's like, nobody remembers they were there.
It was wild. There's a great movie of the Monterey Pop Festival. I have a video. I bought that as part of my research, and you get to see all that stuff, Jimi Hendrix doing his thing. But part of the interest is the crowd. They show a lot of crowd shots, and you get to see really the cross section. You had sort of in that time period, you were phasing out of the beatnik era, which was basically the 50s. And coming into the hippie era, but also you had all the kids from Berkeley across the bay, And they were more upper class, you know, well-dressed people. And so you look in the crowd and you had all these people. You had middle-aged people, you had hippies wearing flowers in their hair and feathers and everything. And then you had people in their nice suits and so forth. So it's really a sociological thing to see what happened at that festival.
Absolutely. Yeah. My mom was one of the hippie, but my parents were from straight laced, you know, Indiana, conservative sort of background stuff. And so for them, it was like, woo, we get to go out and be crazy. And my mom, I always tell everybody, I've been to a Jimi Hendrix concert because my mom saw him when she was like 6 months pregnant with me. So I was there. And I always rely on, I think it's one of his last ones because I was born in 71. But she was pretty far along pregnant with, but maybe she's a little bit further along, but she said she felt sick the whole time and couldn't really enjoy it because she was so pregnant and felt like she threw up and stuff. So, but I get to say I was there because I was there. But it's a cool era. It's very, I'm always been fascinated with it. So I look forward to reading that book. So that's really cool. So let me give you the first official question now that we've gotten to know each other. How did your writing career, because you've had a long and storied career writing, as we've heard, and National Geographic is one of the most well-known things in the entire world. How did your writing career get started, Paul?
Well, I guess it came out of my love of reading. I was always a voracious reader, even in grade school. I remember I won a prize one year in grade school. I think it was the fifth grade because I had read more library books than anybody else. And I carried through high school. When I was in high school, I subscribed to National Geographic and Saturday Review on my own. I was like 12 or 13 years old and I was reading Saturday Review. And that carried on into college. And I really had no goal in mind when I went to college. In fact, I didn't declare my major till I was toward the end of my sophomore year. I was just taking general ed. And I just thought, well, you know, I love reading. Why don't I become an English major? I'd get to read novels and they'd give me credit for it. I couldn't believe it. It was so easy. So I became an English major and they had for a little school where I went, Central Missouri State College, which was near my home in Missouri. They had, they didn't have a journalism department, but they had a journalism minor, which was in the English department. So I minored in journalism and that's where I got started. My junior and senior year, I wrote for the campus newspaper. Then when I got my degree, bachelor degree in English, a week later, I got my draft notice. That was 67. And you know what was happening in 67.
Yeah.
And so I ran down to the post office and tried to join the Air Force because everybody said, oh, the Air Force is the cushiest branch. You know, you eat well, they don't shoot at you, join the Air Force. They had a 9-month waiting list. So I went next door to the Navy recruiter. He said, sign here, son, and you're in the Navy. So I joined the Navy and they made me, because I had a degree in English and journalism, made me a Navy journalist. And I spent 4 years writing for Stars and Stripes, All Hands Magazine. I did spend my last year in Vietnam, which was, you know, it was terrifying at the time, but it was a great career experience. I got to write a lot of stories in the Navy. But when I got out, I felt like I had a minor in journalism from a small school and I had military journalism experience. I didn't feel like I was ready for the big time. So I went to the University of Missouri School of Journalism, which is like one of the best in the country. And I got a master's in journalism. And my next job out of school was working for a medical journal in Kansas City. I did that for 5 years. And I was really a kind of a fish out of water working on a medical journal. And I thought my lifetime goal would be to work for National Geographic. So I wrote to them and I took a writing test and my golly, they hired me. And I started there in 1979. I retired in 2009, spent 30 years there. So, and then to finish where I am today, when I retired, I'd had this long experience of working for National Geographic in history and travel and culture. And I thought, why don't I piggyback on that? And I've always loved biography. So I wrote 3 collections of biographies about little known Americans. That was my first 3 books after I retired. And after I ran out of ideas about who to write about, I said, why don't I use history and biography, but apply it to my other love, which is mysteries. And that's when I started writing historical mysteries. And that's where I am today. I finished my second one and I'm working on my third one.
Well, that's a really cool, cool journey to get from there to here. That's, you know, you went through a lot of different iterations of your career. Very cool. Well, this is a good question for you, because you do write about, so you have real people in your books, you know, but it's fictionalized, it's historical fiction, but it's always sort of twisted together with some real things that have happened. So that's fascinating to me as a reader and an author. So how do you develop the voices of your characters? Do you keep a Bible or use some other methods to bring your characters to life? And I'm assuming you have to sort of keep a truth Bible too, to, you know, to keep.
Well, I discovered early on that Oxford University has an online website for American biographies of American characters, and it's like $80 a year or something. So I subscribed to that, and I researched the heck out of all my characters. It all starts with the reality of who they were, and then I put them through their paces in my version and my stories. But no, I try never to violate what really happened to them, except when I end up killing them. But other than that, all the music I write about, all the character background, that's all real. Mm-hmm. Now, those are only part of the characters. Then there's my invented characters. And that's what your question probably is more directed at. And when I invent a character, instead of you can't research them because they don't exist, but I sort of go through the same process of building their characteristics. In other words, you write a backstory. Who is this person? And I developed, you know, what do they look like? What's their background? What are their interests? So forth. Even if you don't put that in your writing, it informs you who they are, and it helps you know how they would speak, you know, how they would react. And I think it's especially important that you do create believable characters that end up being victims in your book. Because one of the things I really object to, I read so many books, and people that are killed are like, you know, the local butcher or a TV producer. And that's all you ever hear about them. It's like, why should I care about that person? I don't know who that person is, what they, you know, they're not sympathetic. I don't know anything about them. So I try to make a point of describing my victims well enough that when they do get bumped off, the reader kind of cares about it.
Yeah. The reader has to be invested in any character. Yeah. For it to be worthwhile. Yeah. We live near DC, so, you know, murder is sort of like, unfortunately, an everyday occurrence. You know, so, we're a little desensitized to it. Well, we're Americans. I mean, that's just everywhere.
But, the other way of developing a character is, of course, is basing it on someone you know. And I saw a clever T-shirt in a catalog not long ago and said, be careful or I'll put you in my next novel. And I have actually done that with some people, either, you know, maybe you like them, maybe you don't like them, but you build a character around them and you know them intimately. You know what their quirks are, their personality, and it brings believability to your writing.
Absolutely. And it even doesn't have to be, you know, it's not a direct lift of a person that you know, but a little glimmer of that person gives you enough to build on, you know, this person is just always late or whatever. And so that's just a little quirk that gives them, it makes them more real, you know. Yeah, that's cool. Well, you do a great job with that, because your characters are very, they leap off the page, not to be a cliche, but they do tend to speak to you directly as a reader, I think. I mean, I really enjoy your books very much. So,
thank you.
Yeah, you're good at what you do. So which comes first for you, the plot or the characters? This is another related question.
Well, it's always the plot. And I have a friend who's a successful screenwriter, and he sent me a book once by, I think the fellow's name was Sid Field. He's a kind of a guru in screenwriting. And he talks about building your story around, you know, you introduce your protagonist and your what his problem is, what his challenge is, what does he want, right at the front, up front. And then in a screenplay, they're usually 90 to 120 pages. A third of the way through, you have what's called a plot point. You sort of turn the action and you do that again two times, and then you have a resolution. So when I'm building a plot, I kind of keep that in the back of my mind and create a story arc. You know, the cliche is you have to know where you're going to end up in order to be able to plot the whole story. It never works out that your original plot is exactly what you follow. You add things as you go along, as you're writing the story, a chapter, you think, oh, I need another chapter to link this or explain that, or, you know, get me from A to B. So, but you have to start with a plot. If you just wildly, this is for me, other people can probably do this off the top of their head and they just start writing. That doesn't work for me. As a lifelong journalist, every story I wrote, one of the things you learn in journalism school is the inverted pyramid. You know, you start with the big facts and you go taper down to less and less. And the reason they structure them like that is because when they ran out of room, they cut the bottom part off. So they always wanted the important stuff at the top. Well, so I've always had structure in my makeup. And that sort of informs my books too. So. And a lot of it's chronological. You know, you kind of pick a time period and you go through that time period. You play off key events, and that helps you structure your story.
Mm-hmm. That's a good, that's actually a really good tip for people that are maybe listening that are thinking about writing, because you do, if you follow the journalistic model and the screenplay model, somewhere in there, putting those two together, it's important elements that will give you a novel. You know, exactly. You have to highlight the important, you know, moments, and it can't just be a really cool thing happens in the beginning of the book and then it just sort of drifts on forever. You have to punch it up each time. You know, people get bored, they will stop. They'll stop reading you. You'll stop reading your book if nothing is happening. That's a really good way of putting it. That's really interesting that you've sort of used those two disciplines together to be a novelist, and your books are always really tightly plotted. So that's, I can see where that's come into play with you, and that might be helpful for other people too, to sort of think about that. Cool. So, well, how did you arrive at the premise of your series? Because we talked a little bit about your music, and how did you arrive at what made you sit down and say, okay, I'm going to write these historical novels about, and always have a flavor of music through them?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, we were just kind of chatting freeform, I've always had an interest in music, first just as a listener, and then when I took up the guitar, and then when I had that idea about writing about the blues artists, that's sort of where it all gelled. And the natural thing to do would be to involve them in the crimes as I go along. They have those people have to do with music are the victims. So that's where it all evolved from. I think I've written more nonfiction than fiction. My whole journalism career was nonfiction. So when I got to the point of wanting to try my hand at fiction, it was easier to rely on history, rely on biography. And for me, these aren't just crutches, but they are in a sense, but they also generate the kind of story that I'm interested in. Now, I know a lot of novels that are called historical novels, to me, are really period novels. They simply are set in a period, and they don't play off of the events in that time period. The opposite extreme is historical novels that go overboard, and all you get is there's a fellow who writes novels set in the Middle Ages, and I have a hard time getting, his stories are interesting, but he bombards you with so many details about that period and so many odd words, and you have to keep going back to the glossary in the back saying, what the heck is he talking about? So I try not to do that. I try to keep it interesting for a general reader who's not a history buff like I am. So,
yeah. You don't hit people over the head with your knowledge.
Exactly.
You feel like you're getting preached at instead of entertained. Well, my books are culinary, and there is a, you know, an urge sometimes to be like, well, this is how you spatchcock a chicken, but it's like, yeah, that's cool to know. it's not that interesting. It's not that entertaining to read about, you know, in a novel. So, I mean, I know how to do it. So you just have to sort of allude to the, you know, the pieces. I mean, I could talk to you about it all day, but you know, that's not the most interesting thing to read about in a book. But yeah, I totally hear what you're saying. Cause so it is a balance. You have to, you want, you know, the reader to pick up a little, you want them to feel immersed in the time period. And maybe right. a little something along the way, but not, it's not a history book.
Well, one of the, I picked out two books from my bookshelves, and two of the ones I think are extremely successful in that way to approach history. One of them is The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco. Uh-huh. That to me is one of my all-time favorite historical novels. It's set in the 14th century in Italy and a monastery. There's all this history about the church and about Catholicism, and you really get a sense of the period. And there's a wonderful mystery wrapped around it. And they made a great movie out of it with Sean Connery. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie, but yeah, it's terrific.
It's one of my favorite movies. I love that
and movie. The other person who does an excellent job of handling history within a novel is Laurie R. King, and her stories about Mary Russell and Sherlock Holmes. I'm a big Sherlock Holmes fan. And when I've always been skeptical of writers who try to graft their stories onto the Sherlock Holmes persona. Mm-hmm. But man, does she pull it off.
Yeah.
The Beekeeper's Apprentice is the one I pulled out of my show. In fact, I started reading it again last night. So I'll be stuck. I'll be wrapped up in that for the next couple of days. So.
Yeah. She's also, very nice. She's a nice lady.
You know, it's funny. I've read some of her modern ones. She has a Kate something or other, a modern detective. Mm-hmm. And I don't care for her.
Really?
I think it's the jarring effect of going from these wonderful stories set back in the early 1900s to a kind of a hip modern woman detective. That is too jarring. I like the Mary Russell character.
you know what you like, and that's what you like. And that's it. Yeah.
Well, I also love the Ellis Peters stories, all the Cadfael. Brother Cadfael stories. And of course I own the videos on those too with Derek Jacobi, all those wonderful movies he made. So I guess I like the Middle Ages.
Yeah, I think you have a type.
My next book will be set in the Middle Ages.
Yeah, you definitely have a type for sure.
Yeah.
Well, so my fifth question is, I was asking something a little bit out of the realm of writing. And I haven't asked this one very often. If you couldn't write, what would you be doing instead? What would you do instead?
Well, I told you earlier about my dilemma with buying expensive guitars. I think at one point I told a friend my goal was to own every guitar in the world. Because I was buying, you know, like $2,000 Martin guitars and trying to find ways to hide this purchase from my wife. So when I started making my own guitars, I really got, actually I've made several different instruments. I've made ukuleles, a steel laptop guitar, a dobro. I've made several different instruments. And it's just an engrossing hobby. It would be like stamp collecting or bird watching or whatever. You just get wrapped up in it. And it's so much fun. And of course, I studied the history of guitar making and how they evolved and, you know, from classical guitars and so forth. And the first successful steel string guitars were named after Martin.
There you go.
Yeah. So there
you go. Well, it does not surprise me that you fully immerse yourself in the entire subject and know it inside and out, because that strikes me as how you handle most things that you do.
I am a little obsessive compulsive, as I think you may have noticed.
Yes, that I know. Yes, I know. Well, I am too, so that's why I recognize it in other people, because yeah. I have a lot of obsessive tendencies as well. And I used to be a musician, so I played violin all through school, and that was sort of what everyone thought I was going to be. And I played, you know, really well. And I did know how to read music because they showed me how to read music. You know, they taught me that. but I also could play my violin. My private instructor was a cellist, and she would play something to me and I could just play it back to her. So that was first chair, honors orchestra, all that stuff.
And oh, that's
then, but I did not like practicing. The other part about me that you know is I'm a rule defier, and I don't like practicing, because I was like, I just wanted to read books. I just wanted to be in my room listening to the Beatles or reading books. It was boring for me to practice all the time. And also I could show up and it would be fine and I would be good. So I didn't want to put the work in. I just didn't, but I would sit and read all day and write. And you know, that's where I poured my energy. And you know, my mom was disappointed because she wanted me to go to Juilliard and be a famous violinist. And I said, oh, I'll probably end up, you know, busking in the subway or something. But I'm knowing me, but yeah. So, but I do love music. I'm still a huge music fan. So we have a lot in common, even though and we both love wine, because you had a winery. Do you own a winery, or you?
It was just a personal winery. My wife and I bought a parcel of land out in Rappahannock County. Mm-hmm. We had 77 acres, and I put in a vineyard. I had 100 grapevines. I had 4 different varietals, and I usually made about 40 gallons a year, which was plenty for family and friends. And as most I do with most things, I studied viticulture. I took classes through Virginia Tech Extension here in Falls Church, and you know, learned how to grow and make wine, and it was a lot of fun.
Some
people say it's crazy and a lot of work, but I thought it was a lot of fun.
Well, it sounds fun. Sounds amazing. That's a lot of, that's not, when you said 77 acres, like that doesn't sound small. 40 gallons doesn't sound small either, but that's pretty cool. That's really cool. You've done a lot of interesting things aside from writing. Very, very cool. Well, I am a wino too. So we have a lot in common, Paul, you and I. All right. You have a quiz. You ready? A 5 question quiz.
Oh, okay.
You're probably not going to get any of them right, but it's okay. Number one, beach or mountains?
Without a doubt, mountains. I love to go to the beach, but there's a sameness to it. And in the mountains, it's always different. My wife Janice and I used to backpack, and we'd go up to Shenandoah and hike all over the place. We lived in California for 3 years, hiked all over the Sierras, and it's got to be the mountains.
Cool. I differ with you there. I admire the mountains, but I will sit on a beach all day. I grew up in Florida. I grew up in Miami, near Miami, there's a lot of Cuban culture there. So that was another fun thing to read about your book, because I was sort of familiar with some of the, you know, I definitely have heard all that. That music was the music of my childhood, you know, walking outside my house. Question 2, cake or pie?
That would be a hard choice for me. I think I'd have to take a slice of each.
That's a good answer. No one's ever answered like that before. You are also a rule breaker. Are you a morning person or a night owl?
Oh, morning. Yeah, I have a routine that by 9 o'clock I've done everything, had my breakfast, read the paper, taken a shower, done my exercise, I'm awake, and I can blast through 3, 4, 5 hours at a sitting and focus. After that, I start losing my focus, you know, and I find I just repeat the same thought, or I just can't keep going. But when I'm fresh, I think it's partly my age. I mean, when you're older, you get tired sooner. And so I get up in the morning and I write like heck. I go crazy. I do all my stuff. And then I go take a nap if I feel like
it. Yeah, you burned it at that time. Yeah, I like to get up early too. I mean, I used to live in New York City, so I was pretty much a night owl then, because you're just out. You're late. It's late. It's a late kind of city. But and I was younger and didn't have kids and stuff. But now I like getting up really early. It's amazing what you can get done between 5 and 9 in the morning. And there's no one, it's not a lot of distractions either. And I think that's why it's so productive of time, because the rest of the day, it's just, you know, people walking around outside my house, people are calling me, you know, nobody's calling me at 7 in the morning. So I get a lot of stuff done then. Very cool. Oh, I know the answer to this one, I think. Dogs or cats?
Oh, it has to be a dog. Not only do I love dogs, I'm allergic to cats. I can't be within 5 feet of a cat without going into a sneezing fit. So
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, you got to be careful with that. You end up in the ER. One of my friends is allergic to cats. And even if she'll go to a party and the people will have cleaned their house, you know, had someone come in and clean, they have the cats in the basement all day, and she still, it's just something that, you know, it just gets her. So she has to be really careful where she even goes. Not good. Be careful with that. Coffee or tea?
I would, again, it's like I drink probably more tea, but when I go to a coffee shop, I always get coffee. Mm-hmm. I mean, at home, we drink a lot of chai tea.
That's good.
And when I go out, I always get a latte.
Okay. So you're on the food ones, you're going right down the middle.
Right.
That's cool. Very cool. Well, that's, those are correct. All, you got an A. You got an A+. So what's going, well, we heard about the new book you're writing, which is very, that's very exciting because, you know, that's my era. I will be looking forward to reading that for sure. What are you up to? What's life like for you book-wise right now? Are you going out and doing events? Are you doing some Zoom things? What's going on? You got some really good reviews too. What's going on next for you?
My book released yesterday and I spent the entire day firing off emails to all the relevant groups, making Facebook posts. My small hometown of Clinton, Missouri has a website called You Know You're From Clinton Too. And they have over 1,000 members. So I posted on that, posted on my Facebook page and sent out nearly 300 emails to reviewers, friends, colleagues, associates, family. So that pretty much took up the day yesterday. Mm-hmm. Next on the horizon is I have 3 reviews coming out in the November issue. I think it's the November 8th issue of Publishers Weekly. I'll have a review. The November issue of Historical Novels Review, I'll have a review. And then my third one is the San Francisco Book Review, goes online this week.
Those are awesome places.
They're all good reviews. And then the fourth thing that's coming up is I have an ad, which I showed you yesterday, coming out in Mystery Scene Magazine. And I'm really hoping that pulls some because, as you know, that's on the newsstands for 3 months. And you pointed out it's in Barnes & Noble and so forth. So I hope people
see it. It's a great magazine. Yeah, it's a wonderful magazine. Everyone should subscribe to Mystery Scene Magazine if you're a mystery fan. And the people that own it are wonderful people and they're so supportive of the mystery community. They just, you know, they come, they're at BoucherCon, they're at Malice, they come, you know, they support.
Kate and I was a dream to work with.
Oh yeah, yeah, they're wonderful. So for sure, that's a big plug for Mystery Scene. Everyone needs to have that in your life for sure. If you're listening to this podcast, get Mystery Scene Magazine or go to Barnes & Noble and buy it. They should go buy it at the store because it's there. And you'll see Paul's book in there. And multiple other ones. Well, I appreciate you spending time with me today. This was a fun chat.
Yes, it was. I really enjoyed it.
Good. We'll see. We figured out that we have music and books. I was an English major too. We have the 60s, you know, we have all these things that we connect with. So that's awesome. And I'm a big fan of your books and your writing. So there you have that too.
Thank you so much.
Okay, well, thanks again, and I will talk to you again soon, and good luck with everything.
Okay.
And thanks for being on the show.
Okay, thank you, Sean.
Welcome.